listener-supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
You're invited to tune into KBOO's Blues Junction Saturday evening, April 20th at 5 o'clock for a musical conversation with Gulf Coast singer-songwriter Rich Layton. We'll explore the crossroads of twang and tremolo as Rich performs live in the KBOO Air Room. So remember, Blues Junction, Saturday, April 20th at 5 for Gulf Coast singer-songwriter Rich Layton. Once it made you
to crawl, but the fat cats... Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre. A place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM. Or KBOO.FM. Where we make musical structures for the listener to enjoy.
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll examine the ongoing, decades-long fight for justice for the survivors of the Bhopal disaster in India, the largest industrial accident in world history. Amnesty International's Mark Dummett will explain how people are continuing to suffer while Dow Chemical drags its feet and how justice can be won. Then we'll turn to the trend among elite higher education institutions of resuming SAT requirements. As schools like Yale, Harvard, and Caltech resume SAT scores in their admissions, Harry Fetter of the group Fair Test will explain why standardized testing is sexist, racist, and classist, and how thousands of schools remain test-free. Finally, Stephanie Abraham commemorates Arab American Heritage Month with a look at how communities in the U.S. can use it to demand justice for Gaza. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. It's been nearly 40 years since the world's worst industrial disaster claimed the lives of thousands of people and continues to impact more than 500,000. Justice is elusive for the survivors of the Bhopal disaster in India, who are living with the impacts of an unprecedented chemical leak from a plant run by Union Carbide Corporation in 1984. Dow Chemical, which owns Union Carbide, has refused to properly compensate victims or conduct a thorough cleanup. Litigation is ongoing in both India and the United States. Amnesty International, which has been documenting the disaster for years, has just released a new report called Bhopal, 40 Years of Injustice. And my guest is Mark Dummett, Head of Business and Human Rights at Amnesty. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
So it's quite interesting that there's very little awareness here in the United States as a whole of what happened in Bhopal, even though currently it's an American company that is on the is on the hot seat, if you will. And it was, as I mentioned, the world's worst industrial disaster. But perhaps because it happened 40 years ago, a memory seems to have faded. And yet this is an issue that is, in Bhopal especially, absolutely not a thing of the past, right? How are people still living with the impacts of this disaster 40 years, nearly 40 years later?
Well, that's right. It isn't a historical case. It's not a historical disaster. It's a disaster which began in 1984, on the 2nd of December 1984, but it's continuing today. And that's why Amnesty International continues to beat the drum, as it were, on behalf of the survivors of this terrible disaster, to promote their voices and to share their stories of suffering and resilience in the face of this, you know, absolutely appalling tragedy. As you said, thousands of people died within days. 500,000 people have suffered from life-defining injuries as a result of this chemical leak. And the vast majority are incredibly poor already. So as well as the physical suffering that they've had to endure, the injuries have also pushed them further into poverty. And the various efforts by the Indian government, by the American companies involved, Union Carbide, which was American, and Dow Chemicals, which then bought out Union Carbide, the various efforts to provide compensation, to provide healthcare, have been incredibly, utterly inadequate. It is a terrible story of injustice, of a failure to hold this company to account, of a failure to look after the survivors of this disaster. It is a story of two countries, India and America. And one of the things the campaigners have always said is, would this have happened in the US, if an American company had caused such a terrible toxic leak, what would have happened? Would they have responded differently? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. They would have responded differently if the disaster had happened at home in the US.
So there's so many different angles on the injustices that continue. 40 years, as we said, is a long time. There have been several generations of people born since then. How has the contamination that continues in that area impacted either genetically through genetics passed down from parent to child, or from existing environmental contamination from 1984? How has that impacted younger generations of people in Bhopal?
Right, it's a really good question and an important issue, this. And I mean, to me, it is the most shocking aspect of this whole sad story. And it's a reason why we've included in our report actually quite a lot of photos, photographs taken of the survivors and their children, because what we're seeing now in Bhopal is a third generation of people being born, of children being born, obviously, with congenital disorders. So the impact of this appalling toxic chemical has been passed down now to a third generation and is causing injury to newborns and has caused injury to young children. That's one side. You also talk about the pollution which is still there, and that's because the factory site was never properly cleaned up after the disaster, and the contaminants on the site. And this is a plant, a chemicals plant, which was built in this city in central India. The contaminants continue to leak, to leach into the groundwater. The groundwater, which provides drinking water to tens of thousands of people. And they're continuing to be poisoned by this water. And according to researchers working on behalf of some of the community health groups, which have been organized by the survivors and their supporters globally, including many in the US, who have donated to some of these healthcare initiatives. According to this research, this water has continued to spread. This poisoned water has continued to spread. So today, 40 years after the disaster, or almost 40 years after the disaster, even more people are being impacted in this absolutely dreadful way.
So when we think about what is needed, immediately comes to mind, well, why haven't survivors sued Dow Chemical? Why haven't they tried to hold this company accountable legally? How much is complicated by the fact that we're talking about Indian survivors and a U.S. legal system that's, you know, on the other side of the planet? And we're talking, as you said earlier, about poor people and a rich corporation. What is the status of the litigation?
The litigation, incredibly, has gone on all this time. It is due to a large part down to the strength, the commitment to the bravery of survivor groups that the litigation has continued. They are incredibly strong campaigners fighting on behalf of a much wider group of people, and it's thanks to them that this issue is really still alive. That they're the ones who are motivating groups like Amnesty to speak out about it. And I think, to answer the first bit of your question in terms of what's the solution has got to involve them. They've got to be at the center. The survivor groups have got to be at the center of any solution. Dow Chemicals has got to talk to them. The U.S. government, the Indian government. They all need to come together and to come up with a solution to this multifaceted problem involving all these health issues that I was describing, the socioeconomic problems as well, the contaminated waste which still hasn't been cleaned up. This all needs to be fixed. Now, yes, there have been a number of court battles in the U.S. A U.S. judge dismissed the claims brought by survivors in the US, stating that India was the correct jurisdiction for these claims to be heard. In India, the Indian government did reach an out-of-court settlement with Union Carbide over compensation, but the amount they agreed to was woefully inadequate. It was a fraction of the amount that the Indian government had previously assessed was needed to properly compensate the survivors of this disaster.
Was this the $500 that someone commented was more than enough for an Indian?
Right, exactly. It was an utterly, as I said, inadequate amount. The survivors pushed for many years to get the Indian Supreme Court to overrule that settlement, but that the Supreme Court ruled against them last year. And then there's a separate thread, which was a criminal case, which was brought by the Indian authorities against company managers or factory managers, including Warren Anderson, who was the head of Union Carbide. He was arrested when he was in India just days after the accident, but then after the US government put pressure on the Indians, he was released. The criminal case saw a group of Indian company managers actually go to jail for a period of time for their negligent actions, which contributed to the disaster. But the American accused have never been extradited from the US. So one of the calls that the campaigners have always asked for, and Amnesty as well, is calling on the US government to make sure that those accused do face justice in the US, are extradited. Although of course it's many years ago, and several have passed away in the intervening period.
What about grassroots efforts to support the survivors? You mentioned that there have been some efforts around healthcare, and even some that are funded by individual donors here in the United States, progressive-minded individuals, justice-minded people. What are some of the ways in which you're seeing grassroots efforts to help the victims, and also ways in which those here in the United States are showing solidarity?
It's so important, this international solidarity for the survivors. Anyone listening to this can just go into Google and search for the Bhopal Medical Appeal or the International Campaign for Justice for Bhopal and see for themselves on those websites what the survivors and their international supporters are doing to bring essential healthcare to tens of thousands of people, to continue to fight for accountability and justice. It's quite extraordinary the extent to which, you know, 40 years on, as I've said before, they're continuing to push for justice. And one of the reasons why we wanted to put this report out now was to draw attention to, you know, to some of their successes as well, that they've had, some of their small victories that they've had in terms of being able to provide extra support to the survivors. The other thing I would say in terms of what people can do to support them is to put pressure on Dow Chemicals. And last week we made a call directly to the companies, most of which, or the largest of which, are US firms, those investing in Dow, to use their influence on the company to force it to go to the table to come up with an adequate compensation package for the survivors. Dow's response is outrageous. Dow's response is that it is not responsible because at the time of the disaster, the factory was operated by Union Carbide, and it only bought Union Carbide 16 years after the disaster. But of course, it has bought the company. It has also bought everything that the company does and had done. It ultimately remains responsible for providing remedy for the victims of this disaster.
And I imagine that Dow tries to use plausible deniability in avoiding accountability, saying that that it's not responsible because Union Carbide was responsible. But if you buy a company, you buy everything that goes with it.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you go onto Dow's website, or you check out Dow's Twitter feed. It presents itself as a very sustainable, a very ethical organization, a company that cares about diversity and inclusion, but at the same time, it is refusing calls from the survivors to provide adequate compensation for this disaster. And I think if there's anything that we can do as activists, it is to try and put pressure on Dow in whatever way we can to use some of its absolutely enormous wealth to provide this meaningful remedy that the people deserve.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Mark, for joining us. Is there a website? Can you give out Amnesty's website where people can get a hold of the report themselves?
Amnesty.org. Very simple.
And we'll post a link to that from our site as well. Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Mark Dummett, Head of Business and Human Rights at Amnesty International. This December, it'll be 40 years since the Bhopal chemical disaster, the world's worst industrial accident. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Harvard University and the California Institute of Technology last week announced they would return to requiring SAT and ACT test scores as part of their admissions processes. Starting before the COVID-19 pandemic, universities had begun to drop test requirements. The pandemic lockdowns accelerated the trend, and soon thousands of institutions had become test-free or test-optional, including all University of California schools. Now, some elite schools, such as Harvard and Caltech, are backtracking in spite of decades of research showing the SAT is biased against women, people of color, and low-income applicants. My guest is Harry Fetter, Executive Director of Fair Test, the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. He's also a former New York City public school teacher and former litigator. Welcome to the program, Harry.
Thanks, Sonali. Great to be here.
So first, let's talk about the fact that there has been this body of research for decades, as I mentioned, showing that the SAT is deeply, deeply biased. There's also lots of information out there on the internet about the very racist origins of the SAT. And yet schools for so long clung to this test, you know, and they did so, I guess, out of a way to say that, well, there has to be one single standard. Why do you think this test lasted for so long? And, you know, I guess that'll help us understand why it continues to last in some schools.
Well, do you want the nice answer or do you want the cynical answer?
No. I want the real answer. I want the truth.
Well, look, the as you said in your intro, the tests have racism and classism baked into them. And all you need to know to prove that is just look at the College Board's and the ACT's data, which show the performance based on family income and wealth and based on race and disadvantaged minorities, and as you said, lower class students just don't perform as well. And, you know, so you ask why. I think that there's lots of reasons. There is bias baked into the test. There's also the schools and the school systems and the cultures around how, from, you know, first grade through 12th grade, certain schools and school systems sort of feed in to this track of quote unquote elite education. And that is an exclusionary track. And, you know, if a system is working for the people who run it and for the people who came through it, there is very little incentive to change that system. So I would suggest that the reason that they stuck with it is, as you said, it seems to provide an objective measure because everyone takes the same test under sort of identical, pretty much identical conditions. But what that test doesn't do, and not to sort of get deep into psychometrics here, but what it doesn't do is sort of give you a reliable indication of the individual talents of any particular student. And since the test is designed and gives the impact and the result that we've indicated, it by virtue of it, the sort of statistical results, you are going to kind of perpetuate who winds up attending Dartmouth and Harvard and Yale. Right. And I think that that's kind of the de facto way it was done. It's also, frankly, for the college admissions offices, it's the cheapest and easiest thing to do. They basically farmed out their process to these, quasi-public outfits, which are really private companies, the College Board and the ACT. And they say, we will, you know, you have this test that is it's norm referenced, so only a small slice of kids can actually do well. It's not a criterion reference test. It's not saying, let's see who meets a certain standard. And, you know, the fact that it gets, people complain, it's like, oh, SAT scores are up, SAT scores are down. The fact of the matter is only a certain percentage of kids are going to get above a 1400 on the SAT. And that percentage is skewed by race and class. So I think it's what we see is kind of a self-perpetuation of the power structure. And this test has been a very good tool for that.
Now, what was it that led to universities beginning to drop the SAT? Mm-hmm. I mentioned that this sort of started before the pandemic. Yeah. And then during the pandemic, it accelerated, perhaps for practical reasons, because, of course, it became hard for, you know, during the lockdowns, right at the time when students would be applying or getting ready to apply. There was about a year and a half of lockdowns in various parts of the country, and they couldn't go personally to testing centers. So what was it that started this trend? You know, we know what accelerated, but what started it?
Well, I think there were some universities and university admissions offices that saw that they were not attracting a diverse pool of candidates. They also saw that when they sort of looked at the test, they realized that what the test was giving them was not necessarily what they wanted in a student. It's a very narrow measure of knowledge and skill. So there are plenty of smart people, and I use that word broadly, plenty of intelligent people, plenty of highly talented people who just don't do well on these particular instruments. And so I think there was a move at, you know, there were some liberal arts colleges like Bowdoin, some other places like Wake Forest, and eventually, you know, I would say sort of the top ranked academic school to go test optional before the pandemic was University of Chicago. And I think there's just a realization that these tests are bad measures. They're discriminatory. They sort of put a thumb on the scale of a holistic process when a university is trying to produce, you know, to take in an incoming class that is not only reflective more of the general population of the United States or regionally or locally, but also has a diverse array of talents and, you know, sort of fast processing math problems is not necessarily what we want an entire student body to be their, you know, their calling card.
So they realized that this was happening. And at the same time, I understand that there was this lawsuit by the Compton Unified School District, particularly against the University of California system and the UC right. systems. That's yes. an interesting aspect of the story, right? Tell me about this lawsuit and what happened.
Well, I think, you know, this is a California thing, and I'm not sort of, I haven't read the papers or anything from the, but the lawsuit essentially prompted the UC SIMS system to look at the test because on its face, the test had discriminatory impact for admissions. Also coupled with the, you know, California constitutionally under its, or it was a ballot initiative, had gotten rid of affirmative action before the United States Supreme Court did. And I think that there was a realization in the California state system that the numbers of low-income and racial minority students who were getting into or being admitted into the, particularly the top tier of the UC system, the numbers were getting smaller. And as the population of California diversified, that on its face was a problem. And I think the system saw that, in addition to the pressure from the lawsuit, obviously, because the lawsuit said, hey, you're using this instrument that is discriminatory as the basis of admissions, and you can't do that. And so this was the result of both the lawsuit and internal studies in the UC system, principally by their researcher, their head researcher, a man named Saul Geiser, who basically had at his fingertips all of the data of the UC system and his study, which, by the way, has not been trotted out in the New York Times the way the Opportunity Insights study has been trotted
out. We need to talk about that. So here you have a situation now where the University of California system, with all of its campuses up and down, the most populous state in the nation, have said they will permanently forego SAT requirements. This is huge.
And it's not just test optional, it's test free.
Exactly. They will permanently forego it. Yeah. You don't submit it even if you've taken it as part of your admissions, which is huge. And thousands, as your organization points out, thousands of schools remain either test free or test optional in addition to that. But you have this core group of elite Ivy League schools that are saying they're going to go back to requiring SAT requirements. And a big part of that was not only a study by Opportunity Insights, this research institution that claimed that was a good correlation, but also an article by David Lenhardt, the New York Times education reporter. Let's talk about these two. Tell me what these two studies/reports said and why they were taken seriously by just a sliver of elite institutions.
Well, they're taken seriously because it's on the front page of the New York Times, and it's a study published by under the guise of Harvard. So immediately that lends it gravitas, whether it's accurate or not. I don't know that I want to pick apart everything about the study or the article. Clearly, this was a campaign to change the zeitgeist that had been shifting very heavily against standardized tests for use for admissions purposes. And there was obviously, there are folks who just think, hey, these are objective measures. I did well on this test. I'm a smart person. I'm in charge. Kids need to take this test to get in.
And I had to jump through hoops, therefore everyone else should.
Well, look, David Lenhardt exists in his New York Times world and New York Times bubble. And I confess, I'm sitting here in Brooklyn, New York. You know, I live on a block with journalists and Times reporters and New Yorker writers and all that stuff. So the truth is that there is it feeds a kind of an elitist mentality at that sliver of higher ed. And I think that the Opportunity Insights report, the first part of the Opportunity Insights report that got publicized was the fact that at Ivy institutions, I forget the exact numbers, but essentially they skew dramatically towards the higher socioeconomic strata. So the top 1% of income earners, wealth, or the kids of those families occupy the same number of seats as the bottom 60%, or I'm not so sure that's exact, but I do know one thing, that the top 0.1% has the same number of seats in the Ivy Leagues as the bottom two quintiles, 40%. So say what you will, for the decades that they use the SAT, according to the Opportunity Insights study, the numbers were skewed against low-income kids and Black and brown kids. That's a fact that Opportunity Insights, and they say, now why? Here's why. One, legacy admissions, right? If you are a legacy at Harvard and Dartmouth and Yale, you've got a serious leg up. And while they're going back to the SAT, the one thing that we know statistically has disparate impact, right? Did Raj Chetty stand on his soapbox and say we must get rid of legacy admissions?
He's the lead author of the Opportunity Insights study.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. David Deming, did John Friedman? I haven't heard them talk about that because, that gets a little tetchy because the donors, they want to send their kids to Harvard and Dartmouth. And so frankly, Opportunity Insights speaks a little bit with forked tongue. There's legacy, then there's also the athletes. And I'm not talking about, Division I basketball and football players. I'm talking about you know, the sailors, the yachtsmen, the squash players, all of those elite sportsmen. All of those, you know, the
disproportionately white elites. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I understand that like squash is played by more than just white people. But the point being that, you know, the Opportunity Insights study also talked about athletes. Now, the third thing they talk about is extracurriculars and essays and stuff like that. So what they say is that the sort of the student score that gets ascribed, that if you're wealthy, you have a leg up because, you know, you get your cello lessons from Yo-Yo Ma. You get to play contract bridge, which, you know, is probably like some nice elite little niche. You get Garry Kasparov to give you your chess lessons via Zoom, whatever, right? They're obviously extracurricular. You do the New York Times journalism thing and, you know, you go off to Costa Rica for a summer to do good work that your parents paid 10 grand for. So bottom line is, they said that is gives those, and of course you have the essay coaches and all that stuff. Now, there's an easy solution to that one, which is train the readers of the applications to basically say, okay, I have a kid who's working at the 7-Eleven from 4 to 8 every night, who has an A average at a mediocre public high school. And I have a kid who has all this other stuff, the sort of elite kind of extracurriculars, also has a good average at Dalton. How do I weigh those two things? What you have to do is be able to weigh the working at the 7-Eleven in the same breath as right. the Yo-Yo Ma cello lessons, right? Mm-hmm. But here's the thing, that can be done. What you can't do is change the statistics and the underlying classism of the SAT. And so I think that, and so their rationale is, well, the SAT at least gives us some. The other thing they say is it lets us find the quote unquote diamonds in the rough, right?
Diamonds in the rough. So essentially this is a test that ensures that elitism is preserved, and that includes, you know, basically preserving patriarchy and white supremacy.
Let me just add that the
high,
you know,
income, wealth
yeah,
supremacy.
And the men, the gender disparity on, you know, yeah. That doesn't get talked about so much anymore because our colleges and universities are filled with talented women now. And women tend to do better on GPA in high school than men. And yet when you take the test, men do better than women on average. So, you know, and every single study, one other point, like every single study before Opportunity Insights, GPA is the best measure of high school
right.
GPA,
it's,
how you're going to do in college.
It's not as though they have no measures besides the SAT. So let's talk about this. Does this trend of elite institutions resuming SAT requirements worry you? Or are you, because the UC system has permanently dropped it and thousands remain test-free, thousands of other universities and schools remain test-free and test-optional, does it give you some comfort? And you know, where do you think the movement is to let go of the SAT right now?
Right. Well, it doesn't worry me yet. The problem is that, you know, that faculty committees and donors have a lot of say on testing policies, even if admissions departments want to maintain test-free and test-optional policies. And even at UC, you know, there was an internal fight there. And a lot of the professors at Berkeley and UCLA who got their PhDs, maybe at, you know, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, said, actually, we want the test. Because we have standards, and this is, and without this, we don't have an objective standard. So I do worry. I mean, Caltech flipping, I think, is an example of a change in faculty committee, and they turned on a dime. They weren't even test optional. They were test free, and they haven't talked about the three or four classes that they had coming in who didn't submit the test, whether those kids were any worse intellectually or academically than the ones before it. I think it's just strictly a kind of a reputation thing, and they see opportunity insights. Here's a Harvard study. Now we have something to hang our hat on, so we don't look like total classists and racists, because we have this argument that we need this to find the best and the brightest among the masses.
Give out a website, Harry, for your organization, Fair Test, where people can sure. find out the studies that your organization has done, mm-hmm. the reports you've put out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's fairtest.org, www.fairtest.org. We invite all people to check out our stuff. We put out a report. It's called Why University Admissions Should Remain Test Optional, Test Free. It sort of discusses the Opportunity Insight report in the Times article and how they sort of hid a lot of balls. They cited studies that prove, David Leonhard liked to cite studies that prove their point and not talk about all of the studies that showed that test optional actually works.
Selective research. Well, Harry, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Harry Feder, Executive Director of Fair Test, the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. April is Arab American Heritage Month, a time of year meant to celebrate the history and culture of Americans who claim ancestry from the Middle East and North Africa. Such recognition was hard-fought in light of the decades of demonization that Arab Americans faced after the September 11, 2001 attacks. But in 2024, when Israel is carrying out a genocide in Gaza fueled by U.S. weapons, Arab Americans face a dilemma about how to celebrate their heritage. My guest Stephanie Abraham has written about this in a new story for Yes Magazine. Stephanie is a nonfiction writer, media critic, and public relations practitioner. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, including Yes. She was part of the editorial collective that founded the feminist magazine Makeshift and was the founding editor of another feminist magazine called Loudmouth. She's currently the senior marketing communications specialist at Cal Poly Pomona, and she's been a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back to the show, Stephanie.
Thanks, Sonali. It's so good to be back.
So here we are in the midst of this horrific genocide. We're more than 6 months in. And as you point out in your story, 32,000 casualties, and that is the official death count, of which far too many are children. So as an Arab American yourself, what does it feel like to think about Arab American Heritage Month? You know, a time when Arab Americans are supposed to be flying the American flag and claiming their rightful place as full citizens of the United States. But many of them are seeing people that look just like them, or even having relatives and family members facing a devastating genocide. What's it felt like for you personally?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Sonali. I feel like you phrased it so well in your opening, like at a time when we're facing a genocide of our people funded by our own country as Arab Americans, how do we celebrate? And that is, you know, worthy of a scary face emoji. Like, I just like, what do we do? And I feel like, you know, I really have not embraced Arab American Heritage Month. I think the identity months come with, they're sort of fraught, a lot of times they're assimilationalists. They're like, look at what we've done to build this country, totally ignoring Native Americans and our history of sort of genocide on our own land. And also we live these identities every day of the year, right? So you and I aren't just women in March during Women's History Month, and I'm not just Arab American during April. But that being said, I think there is a unique opportunity right now to really lean into figuring out what it means to celebrate while not looking away from genocide, from the genocide, and from the real heartbreak. And I think it's a good opportunity to advocate and to activate all of us.
So in your story, you talk about, or you talk to several folks who are involved in thinking about these issues. In particular, one person who was actually involved in getting this month recognized as Arab American Heritage Month. Tell me about some of the people that you spoke to in writing the story about rethinking Arab American Heritage Month.
Sure. So I spoke with Warren David, who's the co-founder of Arab America Foundation. They also run the website arabamerica.com. And that organization was really really the sort of wind beneath the wings of trying to get April recognized as Arab American Heritage Month. And his stance is, you know, there's so much about our people and all of West Asia, you know, often described as the Middle East, but also Central Asia, sort of thinking about Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, all these countries that the US has invaded, and it's all over our pop culture. Like, Arabs are portrayed as terrorists, particularly males, men, and women are portrayed as sort of voiceless and oppressed, particularly Muslim women who wear the hijab. So it's just like constant barrage of media. And so he sees Arab American Heritage Month as really an excuse and an opportunity to say, hey, we're human. You know, can you recognize us as human beings? And I think partly that's why the month has sort of rubbed me the wrong way, because it's actually quite difficult to face the fact that anti-Arab racism is still so bad that we're begging people to acknowledge our humanity. And indeed, so much of the messaging coming out of Palestine is, these are women and children. Like, how many images do you have to see for you to recognize our shared humanity? And so, you know, we can't have this discussion outside of empire, outside of US imperialism and our tremendous militarism. This year's budget for the Department of Defense is $1.6 trillion. And I heard a PR professional from the military in 2019, when the military spending had been $700 billion in 2018, which is like, these numbers I can't even comprehend. But he said, you know, it's our job to justify that spending to the American people. And so the way that is justified is to create an enemy within our minds, and for the certainly since 9/11, as you mentioned, but even, you know, even before that, but certainly after, it's been this axis of evil idea that George W. Bush coined for Iraq, Iran, and even South Korea. But sort of this Orientalism of, you know, what Edward Said called Orientalism, just sort of seeing the Orient as, you know, the enemy, right? And we have to have an enemy. And so Arab American Heritage Month is an opportunity to undo that and really celebrate our history, our poetry, our culture, and say, like, we're not just this enemy that you've been taught to see us as.
One of the other people that you spoke to for your story is Rana Sharif of the Palestinian Feminist Collective. And tell me a little bit about what her take on Arab American Heritage Month is.
Yeah, I love, thank you. I love Rana's take. She said, you know, what if we see this as not a one and done, not just a month, but really an opportunity to use it as sort of diving into year-long organizing? And she said, you know, what she really thinks about is, how do we, one, you know, teach people that they're powerful, and two, that collectively our power is really strong, and sort of activate that, right? So if we think about like sending letters to our congresspeople, for example, what if we organize our block or our colleagues at, you know, in the lunchroom. Or so we're not only acting as individuals, but we're working together collectively, and we can see our power to really change things.
And so how can Arab American Heritage Month be a time then to center Gaza and to talk about Gaza? Because it is so fraught. People are getting, you know, fired from tenured positions, the crackdown on free speech when it comes to free speech about Palestine has always been problematic and always been there on campuses. But particularly now it's heightened. And we're supposed to sort of not think about that. The Arab Americans are supposed to not think about that. And it's supposed to instead, as I mentioned earlier, wave the American flag. So how can this community center Gaza, this community and its allies and advocates center Gaza and the genocide in Gaza? You have a number of recommendations in your story about how to do that this month in April.
Yeah, so I think Rana Sharif's, you know, she said that there's an active genocide happening. So number one has to be to stop that, to get a permanent ceasefire, to turn on the water and the electricity, to stop, you know, what the UN has called a starvation campaign from Israel on Palestinian people. So that's number one. And I think figuring out collectively how to stop that is really important. And there's multiple ways to do that in small and big ways, right? So for example, as I mentioned, you know, with our government officials who don't seem to be listening very well to us, but interrupting business as we can, you know, seeing, for example, where our money is. You know, there's a big opportunity for financial advocacy. If you're part of a retirement plan, you know, where are those funds? Are they part of genocide or of funding the genocide? There's, you know, the Palestinian Feminist Collective has a tremendous toolkit. It's a digital toolkit that I highly recommend. It can be, you know, something that you and your friends or neighbors or place of worship or colleagues unpack together. It's very thorough. They put it out in October. And, you know, in there, there's like books to read, films to watch, the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, how to be part of BDS on a personal level and a more wide sweeping level. So I feel like there's lots of ways to do this. And another important thing to remember is, of course, you know, while advocating to stop the genocide, remembering that Palestinians, you know, those of us who, of course, recognize that they're not barbarians, which is what we're sort of being fed by the media, that recognize their shared humanity, we sometimes get confused and think of them as sort of a monolithic, downtrodden, oppressed people. And I feel like it's really important for us to notice just their ability to savor life and to be alive, even in the harshest conditions that many of us would give up hope in. So for example, on TikTok, some videos of the Dubka have gone viral, which is a folk dance traditionally danced in a circle in 17 countries, Palestine being one of them. And people are teaching that to the youth right now. You know, we're talking about youth who are being starved, who have lost their home. And they're learning how to dance, and you just see their joy come out. And so really, like, how do we do both of those things? How do we stop this genocide and not turn away from the brutality while also noticing the resilience and the joy and the culture and the life within Palestinian culture?
And there's also the boycott, divestment, sanctions effort that people can plug into, and you can get apps to figure out how to avoid products that are fueling the genocide. There's active ways for people to get involved. Of course, they can do that all year round, but if they haven't yet done so, April is a great month to do it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And actually, there's a new app created by a Gazan that's called No Thanks. And you can literally scan the barcode in the store and see if the product is problematic or something that you can feel easy, you know, feel okay buying. But also, like you said, talking about, you know, the suppression right now in workplaces and in higher ed institutions and schools. And I argue in the piece that even putting up a virtual background honoring Arab Americans can actually be seen as a pretty radical act now, which I think is both tragic and, you know, sort of enlightening. But St. Jude Research Hospital has a really beautiful one. That hospital was founded by Lebanese American Danny Thomas, and it quotes Khalil Gibran, who was a Lebanese American poet, many argue the first Arab American writer. And it says that he who denies his heritage has no heritage. And I love this in particular because my auntie Sophie was part of the greater Syrian, wave of immigrants about 100 years ago. She needlepointed this, and it hung on her wall for her entire life. So I feel that there's big and small ways right now to be part of, you know, really resistance of anti-war resistance in ways that will be noticed.
Well, finally, Stephanie, is there ever a way to have a Cultural Heritage Month that isn't performative? I mean, I think about Black History Month, which might be, you know, I might be wrong, but I think it is the longest cultural month that we have for any particular non-white ethnic group. And a lot of Black Americans have used that as a way to really talk about issues and as a way to challenge the status quo. And I'm wondering if you think that there's a way for Arab American Heritage Month to kind of aspire to that, although it's a very young month still.
Yeah, I do feel like that is part of the movement. I mean, although, you know, referring to Black Heritage Month or Black History Month, it's the shortest month of the year. And so many people have said that's actually part of anti-Blackness. But, you know, that is part of the rub with months, is that it offers organizations and brands and corporations to sort of perform their diversity, equity, inclusion efforts. So, for example, during Pride Month, they might change their social media handles to have a rainbow flag when really they have like almost no queer employees, for example. So they can sort of look like they're doing stuff when really, if you look at things, they're not doing much. But that being said, I think it is, you know, it does offer an opportunity for a representation that might not otherwise be there, you know, and if it's gonna force brands to evaluate things with fresh eyes, I think that's great. But more than that, I think it's really an opportunity for us to get back activated, right? And there's a slogan going around like, I'm not here to save Palestine. Palestine is here to save me, right? And so we can use this as an opportunity to sort of overcome our feelings of paralysis, our hopelessness, feeling like we can't do anything, and get activated to actually see that, you know, as Rana Sharif says, we are powerful and we're even more powerful collectively.
Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and we'll post a link to your story in Yes Magazine from our website. Good luck to you.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Stephanie Abraham, a writer and media critic, and you can read her latest story at Yes about Arab American Heritage Month in light of the Gaza genocide at yesmagazine.org. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hosting a two-hour live